to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good morning, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and this is a pre-recorded interview for July 5th, 2016. I hope all of you Americans out there really enjoy your three-day weekend celebrating the 4th of July and supposedly freedom from our oppressors from the War of Independence. As the rest of the world knows, wars are not the way to freedom. It is from within. And we are certainly on the way to taking back our planet and our power and stopping this oppression. I felt that this interview was very timely because it's all about near-death experiences, which many equate to truly feeling a sense of freedom from this matrix. Now, I think you'll be interested. Eugene Braxton has had out-of-body experiences since he was six and literally continued to have night after night continual experiences for 10 more years. In his childhood, he had lucid dreaming and varying degrees of levels of consciousness, which is just amazing to start so early on. After several years, by the age of 13, he learned to distinguish between what a dream was and what a lucid dream was, as well as out-of-body experiences. He even went so far as to determine the different individual states of consciousness. And because of the frequency and the intensity and how often this happened, as a teenager, at 15, he was able to develop and become an expert in an unusual degree of extreme focused observation and mastering many of the techniques that all of us clamor to and desire to perfect. This is why he has become the mystic, America's most gifted mystic. At the age of 15, he himself experienced a near-death experience. And while he was swimming in the Ohio Lake, he drowned. It was a very profound experience, and it led to the books that he has written. He is in the process of writing a second book as well. So please welcome Eugene Braxton. I think you're going to be absolutely fascinated by what he has brought forth. This is very different than most. It's not just sharing his experience. It's really determining all the details that he was able to surmise. When you go through this experience, what levels of consciousness do you go through? What are the levels and the stages of the actual death? What do they include, and why are they important? I think you'll find this as fascinating as I did. So thank you very much, and stay tuned. If you're new to Galactic Connection, we do have radio shows live on BBS Radio Tuesday afternoons from 3 to 4:55 Pacific Standard Time. Okay. We'll talk soon with Eugene. Hey, everyone. I have Eugene Braxton online with me today. And I wanted to start off the interview with just a very profound quote that you had in your book, Eugene. And it said, the NDE has an order. It has several sequential stages, a clear and orderly structure, repeating patterns, a beginning, middle, and end, which makes sense and are easily seen when examined as a whole, single event, instead of some randomly occurring, meaningless, misunderstood fragment of some murky afterlife memory. And when I read that, I was like, wow, you have really gotten into an area that seems to be very, very prolific. I mean, I was reading your book and very impressed with how you put this whole thing together. So, please do me a favor and just give everybody just a quick introduction of who you are and how you got started in this whole field of near-death experience.
Okay. Thanks, Alexandra.
You're welcome.
Yeah, the research started with some experiences I had. Especially as a kid, and I had a near death, and I watched it, and like the study of it, I had mine in 75. So near death research didn't really start until 77. So for the rest of the 70s, up until about the mid 80s, I watched it when they started coming out with near death experience research. And after a while, mid-80s or late-80s, I saw that mine wasn't the same as some of the ones I was seeing in the media, on TV, Newsweek, and so forth like that. So I just watched, and I was still kind of studying all kinds of things. In the 90s, I saw in Newsweek magazine an article by a near-death researcher who seemed to really believe in it, and that his name was Bruce Grayson. And I thought he was a normal college doctor, you know, Penn or LaSalle or USC, but he turned out to be the world authority. So I decided to tell him everything I remembered about my near death. And I had a lot of experiences as a kid in a lot of different things. But so I wasn't sure what he was going to pick, out of bodies, dreams, but he picked the near death. And so I told him everything I remembered, and that was the beginning of the research start of it, Alexandra.
That's amazing. And, you know, one of the other things I was really intrigued by was you were personal friends with Barty and Betty Hill. How did that come about?
Yes. Barney Hill was from Philadelphia, and we were from Philly, too. Barney and Dad worked at the Philly Post Office before their famous sighting. So they were personal friends, and then they met Betty in the 50s too. So they were friends of the Hills for at least 10 or 15 years before the sighting. And we got to meet them. We would go up every summer, every winter, stay the weekend, hear the story. And I was even able in 99, when Betty Hill was 80, to do like a 3-hour interview, filmed interview with her in her house.
Wow.
So they were, yeah, it was cool knowing them.
That's no kidding. And so this was very common for you to grow up in an environment where UFOs were a real deal.
Yes. we believed them, their story. And then in the 70s, I would have two sightings too. And then one in the 90s with my son. One was like a complete sighting and abduction. Because there was some missing time and some like dramatic after effects with me and my friend Roger in Ohio. One was a complete one. One was one of the blue spheres that we see now. And it just, I was going to work one night or coming home from work, and this thing just bounced over my car and up the Ohio road I was driving on. And it was going so fast and was so low right over the roof. I knew it wasn't a plane or anything. And it was a round sphere. And it just went ahead and zoomed ahead down the highway in front of me. And then my son and I saw a sphere-shaped planet, a UFO, out here near the Philly airport. So, in fact, Alexandra, when we saw that sphere-shaped UFO, that at first looked like the planet Saturn, then the rings disintegrated once we started looking at it. That one, we saw 1 month after we had an extreme experience at a registered haunted house here in Philadelphia. One month to the day. Yes.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you, is you said it was extremely haunted historic mansion. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I had had a lot of inner experiences, like dreams, out of bodies, lucid dreams, telepathy. But I had always wanted to have a physical experience where I saw a chair move across the room, or, you know, a door fly open or something like that. And so we wanted to see if there was a haunted house in our Philadelphia area. So there was. And son again was there. We left him down at the car with his goddaughter. And me and three guys went up, two guys. And we saw what looked like two luminous beams about as tall as telephone poles. And they were one behind each other. They looked like they were walking somehow. They were moving across the back of this mansion as though they were walking. And we got down and looked at all angles, and we could kind of see through them. But they were some kind of actual beams that were walking behind the trees. This haunted house was a Revolutionary War cemetery, and then they built a Civil War soldiers, like, nursing death home on top of that.
Oh, my gosh.
And, yeah. And that was, I would later go back to two films there. And on these films, the females that were in them, we were going to use it for a haunted house / photo shoot. So if nothing happened scary at the house, we would film them as a model, you know, modeling around.
So
that worked out pretty well. There, both girls changed physically on film. Like, one girl had seven different looks in 11 seconds.
Oh my God.
And her hair changed, her eyes changed. There were two. The first girl slid across the cement, and she ran from the house within 3 minutes after we got there. And once on the sidewalk, she began pacing back and forth really weird. And then she slid right across the cement. This was in winter. And the house somehow with her magnified her looks to the extreme. You could see her glowing with this beauty. And we called it Haunted Beauty. And I would later go back and watch her good scenes in slow motion. And instead of like the angelic-like female on screen, there was a witch-like figure whenever I put it in slow motion. So in slow motion, there was a whole other side of her that came out. And I was able to make a second part of the film just showing her all in slow motion. And at one point, Alexandra, she even had a witch's hat on.
Oh my God. So,
yes. I'll have to get you a copy of that.
Yeah. I would love to see that. I would love to. It sounds to me like you really tapped into, you know, prior timelines and the bleed over from ghosts that reside there. I remember going to Gettysburg and having some similar experiences before I knew what I know now. And I just could feel the sadness and the trapped souls. It was very eerie. That was back in the 90s. So that's definitely a place that needs a lot of clearing, huh? A lot of those battlefields.
Yeah. They call it haunted Pennsylvania. And Ohio is kind of like that, too.
Mm.
It's just it's just electric with the paranormal energy and activity. And from all the way across the state, and Ohio's like that, too. It's we're kind of the brother and sister state that are pretty haunted.
Interesting. And now you seem to have just a plethora of experiences. You also talked about even assisting in the location of the death of Julius Erving's son.
Yeah. Yes. I'm glad you read that book and read about that. Because, that was in the year 2000, his son went missing. So I had been trying remote viewing at the end of that decade. After hearing one of the remote viewers describe how to do it on air. So I tried it, and it did work. And it worked really well, except that you, just like you said about the bleed over, you felt exactly what the victim or the target, a human target in this case, was experiencing.
Mm.
And I had, there was a boy, at that time, I was working with the Temple Police. So a boy went missing in California. He was the same age as my son. So I said, when I remote viewed him just to see exactly what was happening, since he was the same age, they almost looked alike. The other kid was Spanish, and I remote viewed that, and I saw what was happening. Kept it to myself, but I told my son I was remote viewing, and on the news that night, they described exactly what I had told my son, except I didn't tell him the part that the boy had been abused before he was killed. So, and you feel like you're at the scene, you feel the emotions. With the Julius Erving, I remote viewed him, and I saw a body of water, a circular body of water, like a lake or a pond. Then I saw the trunk of the car with the face down, or with the trunk of the car sticking up in the water. I could see blood coming from it. I could feel that there was no life there, and the blood was kind of like a physical, visual. And I told a newspaper editor, a radio host, and a temple police officer before anyone knew about it. And a week later, it came up exactly like that. So that was the last time I tried remote viewing. No one told the Dr. J, no one told the basketball player's father, but it was just recommended that I not say that nothing would be said. You know, I just let the police find it and then see if it matches, because I was still trying it, but the remote viewing works pretty well.
So now, let me ask you something. When you do remote viewing, or when you have done it, is that pretty much the norm that you will experience the feeling of... for example, if you're observing a victim of a crime, or do you typically get into the feeling sensation of that victim when you remote view?
With me and with a lot of them, yes. You see it as a spectator, but there's also a emerging part where you in a remote viewing, just like with out-of-bodies, when you start to focus on something, you can also have the ability to merge into it. And psychic experiences bring this merging, they also call it synesthesia. Mm-hmm. They bring this merging ability out. And a person can merge mentally or physically with the object of focus. And like with Dr. Julius Erving's son, I wanted to find out if he was alive or dead and the cause of death. And I was able to see that his cause of death was drowning. And I was able just to emotionally ascertain that he was dead. And also the physical, the blood coming up from the sunken car showed me that he was dead too. But you felt everything, like his, maybe his fear when the car went into the the water, what kind of emotional state he was, like, you know, may it have been a suicide or accident. And so you really absorb everything that's in the scene. Like in a remote viewing, the remote viewer might feel the knife stabs that the victim felt, or he might feel the rage of the killer. So it's a thing where you're just fully absorbed into it. So that's why a lot of them, some of them try not to do it too much, because it's, you take on, like, the, it's almost like you're a witness of the crime too.
Oh my God. I had no idea about that. You know, I've read about remote viewing, but it would appear to me that you really need to be a sound individual, you know, to be able to withstand something like that.
Yeah, and the better in those things, experiences, the better the person can maintain, like, a cool, calm, non-emotional composure, the better. I sometimes say, like, to almost be like a Mr. Spock,
yeah,
where you're just analyzing and feeling and observing, and there is little or no emotion. That's the best way in those things, because it's so overwhelming.
Yeah,
any of those.
I can't even imagine. In fact, you know, am I imagining things, or were you also a police officer?
I worked with the Temple Police for 20 years, yes.
Okay. So was this one of your only experiences in incorporating remote viewing into the work that you were doing?
Let's see. As far as working with them, it was, yes. And I thought about mentioning it, you know, to a lieutenant. We had male and female lieutenants, but I was still practicing it, so I kept the results to myself. But with Dr. J, I decided to tell some people, and one was a Temple Police friend and coworker, Anthony Banks. And that's an interesting thing, that remote viewing, and synesthesia part of it is too, where when a person has a psychic experience or spiritual experience, some of the like you said, some of the leftover, some of the excess, some of the after effects of those experiences are the ability to merge into other things or into other people, like a super empath, like that.
Wow.
And you feel it. With the there's also a lot of like with emotions and feelings, there's a lot to say about that, especially with fear and ecstasy. I guess we can get into it later. There's a lot to say about that, in especially UFO experiences and near-death experiences.
Yes.
They both have, yes. I know you know a lot about those things, especially the UFO realms, and you have some interesting stuff on your website that I'm going to fully study.
Oh, but, hey, you'll be studying for a long time if you're on Galactic Connection. We have something like over 35,000 posts on there. Just, you know, it's crazy. I was going to ask you too, because your book is amazing, because it's covering a topic that's almost like a living room table subject these days. You know, a lot of people are talking about NDEs, near-death experiences, and you know, oh, have you had one, and what was your experience like? And what you've really done is you've brought a construct force and an extremely detailed account of what one goes through. And I can't believe, with your background of not only being an officer, but also a psychology professor, you've brought forth so many different lenses. I mean, I think that's one of the greatest things that came out of the, you know, me reading your book, is what is really happening to people when they go through an NDE. And you yourself, I know, went through one. One of the comments you made was you had a concern over the controller, you know, the controlling agent in charge. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Alexandra. And like you said, I'm glad to have, like, I'm an artist. I'm a film director, independent film director. A writer, and then the officer. And so the visual observing of things is like second nature, or just comes natural.
Bad.
And you're asking about I'm sorry, what just now?
Well, you were saying you had a concern over the controlling agent in charge. Yeah. And I thought that really caught my attention. What did, you know, just to maybe expound upon that.
Yeah. We saw in the near death that there was a, and the doctors, just like the bad near death experiences, the doctors did not want to deal with this controller and were concerned about the amount of control that was exerted on the near-death experiencer during the near-death. Like on the front of my book, you'll see the picture of the figure. It could be man or woman, suspended in air with the arms outstretched.
Yes.
And a lot of near-death is, Alexandra, say that they are in that position when God comes to meet them. And that's at the judgment stage. We also found that there were several stages, just like the paragraph that you read, the quote you read earlier, the near death, as the scientists thought, it was a mixed up random order. It's not. And everything in this universe has an order, and so is the near death. And it's easy to see once it's laid out. And the main problem with that is the memory. Only 1 in 4 near deathers could remember anything at all, a flash of light or blur. And of those who did remember, a lot of them weren't psychically inclined before the near death. There's maybe like an athlete had it, or a nurse, or a cop. And
that picture reminded me of Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man.
That's exactly. In fact, since we're talking about, and the book is out, do you remember the little circle? Remember reading in the chapter of my near death when I regained consciousness after death, and I regained it too. And that Diluvian Man thing is also present. I woke up in a little sphere, Alexandra, and it was moving like a gyroscope. It was moving just like that machine that Jodie Foster got in contact. And I woke up in one of those, big enough for me to outstretch my hands and feet like the Diluvian Man. And this sphere disintegrated as my consciousness elevated. It was in sequence with the consciousness, like within about 4 or 5 seconds, I was completely awake after death.
That's amazing. Now, Eugene, do most people remember this part of it?
I've heard it once or twice.
Wow.
But a lot of people, when their spirit body leaves the physical at death, wake up, we found between 15 and 22 seconds after they physically expire. And that gives the astral body about 22 seconds, 15, to gently come out of the physical. And this is involuntary. Like when people die, their spirit body will automatically come out as that energy has to and will involuntarily go somewhere, and it goes up and then out. And then they usually pop awake about a few seconds, or, you know, 15 to 22 seconds after they exit their physical body. And that's why they usually find themselves floating 8 to 12 feet, 15 feet above their body. And once they look around and see where they are and see their dead body, then they remember that they just died. And I call that the realization of a time and space, because I woke up out of my body. I knew that I existed because I was thinking, like I think, therefore I am. I knew that I was alive somewhere in space, and I didn't know what time it was until I saw my dead body. And I realized it was the time of death, and the space would be the afterlife. It was an interesting and deep experience. That's just like one level of all the, there are about 12 levels. And I think that we could be able to cover all that today too.
Yeah, no, I'm so amazed at how much you were already into at such an early age. I mean, this truly was a gift for you. And it's so obvious to me that this is part of your mission, is to bring this information out so that there's less confusion about an NDE. And you've done such a spectacular job. Please do us a favor. First of all, I have so many questions that are going around in my head. I would love you to depict your death experience at 15, but before you dive into that, I would like the audience to understand that you were really, you were getting into a, I'm going to call it a community of a lot of negativity and restraint and people not really wanting to go outside the box and really push it as far as you have with all the detail and information, right?
Yes, yes. Just like the what you mentioned, the controller. They didn't want to deal with that because it represented a God figure or the opposite of a God figure.
Wow.
And yes, in fact, the controller's actions were so suspiciously anomalous that I began watching it during the near death. And the control was good and loving, but it was complete. And it's outstanding what happens in a full, fully conscious, remembered near death. And almost every experiencer remembers either meeting God, feeling his presence, and then mixing and merging with him. The person will get judged, will be judged, and then they will later meet God in heaven. They meet God like in the second heaven, which would be like the astral realm. God forgives them first. And before the forgiveness, they have a complete life review, which we can talk about too.
Yeah.
God shows them the life review so they can see a visual aspect of their life. Then he forgives them, and then he judges them. And it's a favorable, super easy judgment. If you believe that he is God, or if you had believed, then you're in.
That's
actually how it should be. It shouldn't be any kind of court, you know, it should be simple. So he makes it simple and easy.
So think about it, Eugene. Yeah. Your findings were completely blowing holes in so much of the religious dogma that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there's this very judging God, you know, that everything is all about a judgment in a different way than what you presented in the book is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes. It's weird with the religion spirituality aspect, because religion has a bad name now with the priest and stuff and what they're doing and have done for mm-hmm. decades.
Yes.
And because when we were kids in the 60s, we heard rumors about the Catholic Church and the altar boys, and it was whispered behind. And at that same time in the 70s, people who were hitchhiking began slowly disappearing. And in the late 70s, I would turn into the serial killer thing. But there were, we heard, and everyone knew, and I'm black, but even the black community had heard whispers too, and of the priest and what was going on in the Catholic Church. I had a longtime babysitter who used to take us to her Catholic church.
Interesting.
She lived across the street. But and so people are down on religion, down on God, and religion is kind of, spirituality is better than religion, because man just isn't running religion right. They're just running it into the ground.
Yes.
And now it's almost these days, if you say something about God, people, you know, look at you like, what the hell? So,
well, and you know what I say to people a lot of times is it's much more intense to be spiritual than religious, because when you go down a, as you call yourself, a mystic spiritual path, you are accountable to yourself. You're not receiving a manual that says do this, do that, do the other. You're
yes.
truly walking a path of truth seeking, really going into yourself and taking accountability and looking at the way in which you fit within this massive creation. So it's like all encompassing. It's not just this, oh, I have to pick up this book and it's telling me what to do and how to do it and when to do it. You know, it's mm-hmm. so it's much more comprehensive and challenging.
It is. And like you said, it's a one-on-one thing where it's the individual and the spirit, you know, the spirit. And it's in religion, there are a lot of things that they could teach but don't, or else they don't know about, or else they won't teach. And there were questions I had about things that religion couldn't answer. So I just started studying and finding the answers myself.
Yes.
And
I can totally relate to that one. I was brought up Catholic also. And I have to say, it did give me it provided me a really solid foundation in God.
Yes.
Okay, so
yes.
I'm very grateful for that. And in some ways, I didn't have so much of the, how do I say this? I didn't have as much of the programming, you know, regarding the Bible, because the Catholics, in many ways that, well, at least when I was growing up, most of us didn't read a Bible, even though it was a Catholic Bible. So we weren't like being hammered, you know, 7 days a week that we had to read out of a book that told us, you know, exactly what was a good Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
It was just once a Sunday kind of thing. But anyway, I'm getting off the subject. But, you know, you mentioned too, and I was really intrigued by this, that everybody that has experienced NDEs, they come back with some sort of mental, physical, or psychic gift.
Yes.
And how did that affect you?
In a super good way. In fact, the near-death is due as a side effect is the psychic, like the amplification of psychic abilities, and to a high degree, where if the person isn't used to it before the near-death, it'll be a super shock to them when they get it. Kind of like that movie The Dead Zone with Christopher Walken, where it took them about 5 years to get used to being a different kind of elevated person from the near-death. And so these after effects, the psychic abilities that the near-deathers get, they increase from year to year all throughout the experiencer's life. So they get used to it if they haven't been used to it before. And the after effects are really just being starting to be studied and worked with, because some of the things that you learn from a near-death and evolve into goes way beyond any kind of psychic ability that they may have. There's so much other gifts that come from the near-death experience that, to me, and I'm fully used to all those things, that the psychic after effects are actually hindrances to the continuation of that elevation that the person wants to have in the spirit. And like with the mystic's main goal is to have conscious union, one-on-one union with God. And yes. Everyone can do it. And that's what the mystic is always into, like merging. In fact, a continuous, you know, merging in real time, a continuous 24/7, that would also be the ultimate goal. But anyone can meet God who has created them. Anyone can experience his presence. The person cannot know the mind of God, but they can merge with him and experience the presence of the creator who has created them. It's like natural to mix back in with where you're from.
You know, what was intriguing for me is you talked a lot about you continue to have dreams that were almost warning you before you went through this near-death experience. And I was kind of wondering, do you feel that the dreams and the warning and the death themselves, are they related to, you know, like a past life looping, or is it more of a, did you feel like you came here deliberately to contract this as part of an experience in this life? I don't know. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do, Alexandra. Okay. Yeah, you said it perfectly.
Okay.
My dad, he, in his later years, and he lived to 90, considered reincarnation and thought about past lives. I had heard about it. And I personally think a lot of it's, and I'm still really young in learning about things and about that, but I think that a lot of it's genetically based.
Wow.
I do. I think that people are remembering the genetics from maybe great, great, great grandmother or grandfather, or maybe someone in their lineage. I just can't see where a good God would let us go through this kind of stuff over and over and over. And if he did, it's helpful that he lets us forget it, but to have all those memories would make the human even more of a human. But to have someone go through several lives, erase the memories of those lives, just seems like a game that God wouldn't play with us.
And, I totally agree with you. And, I mean, there are so many things I'm questioning now that we've read in a lot of spiritually enlightened books and articles, etc., that I'm questioning now. You know, especially the whole, oh, we took this as a contract to be, you know, to arrive and be born into this like horrific home, you know, over and over. And then, you know, when you were showing the dreams before the death, what it made me wonder is, oh, did you have this experience in a past life and your dreams were warning you that you were going to go through it again because you didn't, you know, A, learn from it, or was it just merely the fact that we're in some sort of looping sequence, you know? And
exactly, Alexandra. Mm-hmm. In fact, when after the near death and before, like with those, I had some dreams that were warning me about being, about drowning. Mm. And I thought that there was my feet tangled in the blankets. I thought it was just a fantasy type of fear dream, because I'd been having nightmares and all kinds of dreams back then. And I was also on our high school swimming and water polo team. Mm. And those guys, you know, they have to tread water for like an hour without using their arms, and they're super swimmers. Okay. And we used to swim in the Ohio waterfalls during a flash flood. Oh, and we were super swimmers.
Oh my God.
And so I just tossed off the notion of drowning because I was, you know, a water polo player and I swam in the Ohio lakes and water. So I said, there's no way I could drown. And I did other sports too. I was a good athlete. But these repeating dreams, and they were vivid, emotional, and brief. And they were literal warning dreams for about a half a year. And then I did drown. I jumped in a lake, got stuck up into the knee. I could not get out. I was a weightlifter and all that. I could not. It was like tar. And that's how the near death. Yeah. So it was a future warning dream. And I had considered the, did I die in a past life? Is this a memory that maybe I had? I considered that when I was 15, because they kept coming back and it's always the same dream over and over. And just last night, I didn't sleep at all. I slept like from 9 a.m. to 12 or 11:30. I only sleep like 4 or so hours, and I have bad sleep disturbances from the psychic things. But the dreams is, that's a doorway, a safe path and a natural path by which humans can go to all the other wings of God's paranormal mansion. I see that psychic and esoteric experiences are all different rooms in one wing of God's mansion. And
fascinating. And you know, you did talk a little bit about the mirror of truth. And I was hoping you would maybe talk a little bit about that as an adult. What do you feel that mirror of truth has sharpened within you?
I think that one of the best things a person can do is to self-reflect, and not where the person is preening in front of some mirror, but to examine themselves, examine their interior first, and then their exterior world in which they live second. And I think that one of the best things a person can do is to know themselves, and to also to look for themselves, because like you said about this, the world in which we live and how it's almost like this fake type of illusion. And people, you see them walking around with, you know, name brand things on because the guy tells them to wear it, and they have their Timberlands. And it's weird where people aren't really themselves. A guy's in a job that he really is not qualified for. It doesn't really, is not inclined to. And people are just, a lot of people don't want to be themselves, and there's a lot of people who don't want to look for themselves. So I think the outside of us is what we present to the world, is just our second self, and our real self is that inner self. And the person should always try to have a dialogue with their outer physical self and their inner So, and those two should talk and meet. Just like an even better example, and the same example is when the person's conscious mind interacts and communicates with the person's subconscious mind. And those two minds start interacting and agreeing on having or knowing or doing things, it comes to them. It's like that's when the person starts using their consciousness to interact with the universe. And when we reach out to it, it does respond back to us. Mm. So those are some of the kind of things that the near-deathers learn to do, and where it makes those psychic abilities seem like silly. They seem like distractions. When you can consciously interact with the universe and get it to respond to you and you respond to it, or when you usually one psychic experience, a legitimate one, will bring on others until the person is occurrence prone, and the experience is just coming back, come at them back to back to back. And then they start to get used to them and work with them. But I think the best thing a person can do is get to know their inner real self and get to like that self, because in this world, you should have a healthy regard for yourself, because there's some literal lions walking out there. There are people like to smash people's egos. So the person has to know themselves and be strong. Like you said, this is like where the person should be a spiritual warrior. It's some pretty wild times physically and spiritually.
Absolutely.
Happening now.
Absolutely. I can't agree with you more. And we really are, you know, a lot of times I say to people, we are walking in the enemy camp. You know, now I know enemy is kind of a generalization, but we truly are at the end of our old age, where literally we are seeing perversion like never before in every aspect of our life, our society, and the people around us. And it's so important for us to, you know, when it gets really intense and we are grasping for straws to try to find ourselves, and we're blocked from doing that, whether it's, you know, depression or illness or, you know, feeling abandoned, or, you know, just plain old feeling completely shut down psychically, it's so important never to stop communicating with God or some supreme power, you know, that's beyond yourself. It's so important to never let go of that, because that is there. And I think it's the one saving grace, no matter who you are or what you are, that we all have to lean on. In fact, I wrote here, one of my favorite statements in your book was, you must walk, run, and crawl by yourself towards God. Nothing must impede your movement towards God.
Yes. Thanks. And I'm so glad you read it. And, I checked it out. There's that should be the human's primary goal, because it's such a worthwhile goal.
And so important. I mean, especially now, more than any other time, because we are being bombarded from all angles with a force that is not necessarily here for our best interests and our benefit. Now, do you feel that you know, these prerequisites, what do you feel are the prerequisites that you need to have gifts beyond the mortals, in your opinion?
Could you say that again?
Well, what prerequisites does someone need to have in order to attain the gifts that you've experienced?
Okay, yeah. I would say the first one, even beyond talent, is the desire. How much the person wants these things. That's a strong thing, like desire, just like the addict. That when they have their craving for their heroin or alcohol, that desire is strong, or the athlete who wants to win the championship, or the guy who wants to marry the prettiest girl. So the desire is the I would say the first thing. In fact, when I was 9, I knew that there was an invisible world, because I was having out of bodies and dreams and lucid dreams combined. I would have a lucid dream, out of body, and regular dream intertwined. And I would have about 4 or 5 of them a night after night for 10 years. So I thought that there was another world, an invisible world that was real and alive, but that we couldn't see, but that in a lot of ways was more real than this world, and we could be awake in it. So when I was 9, I asked God to show me all of those invisible things more than anyone ever knew, because I had heard about King Solomon and stuff, and we had, you know, there were cartoons and TV with superheroes. So I wanted to know that stuff too, because it was happening to me. So I made a promise to God, a solemn promise, as I was walking home to dinner, that if he showed me all those things, I would always tell people about him. And I wanted to know more than any man or king. And about 2 years later, some heavy experiences started when I was 11.
Wow.
And during the teenage years, they were too much. But I asked for them, and I was forced to deal with them. And I'm glad they happened now, even the near death. But as far as the prerequisites, desire and the ability can be developed. And you don't need to be any kind of super physicist to have esoteric experiences. And a lot of times, the less intellectual you are, the better. It's good to, like you said, have that grounding and be complete and whole, where you also, you know, play tennis in addition to studying hard. And so the talent, so desire is the main thing. And it's good to know when a person knows exactly what they want, they usually get it fast. But everyone can remember being a teenager and going out with your friends and saying, "What do you guys want to do tonight?" And all you get is, "I don't know." And a lot of people don't know what they want, even if it's just one single thing. So when the person decides that they want something and they want it really, really bad, more than anything in the world, and it's a single focus, even though they have secondary goals, but that single focus, once when they want it bad and they focus on an exact thing, it literally comes to them. And I was interested in that part of how the mind and universe works too. But
I just experienced that, Eugene. I blew my mind. I ended up manifesting a home that I had written all these details down on a piece of paper over and over and over again. I even found someone who would take me to these really expensive homes so I could get all these different ideas. Because I'm very detail oriented. That's just something that's one of my fortes. And so I wanted to go all the way down to the detail. And I had taken these courses that manifestation is key when you get, you know, don't just say, "I want a car." You want to put out to the universe, "I want a car that's red and it's shaped like this and it has leather seats," and it's, you know, you want to give all the details to the universe. So I decided to do that and wrote it all down, and ended up manifesting a house unbeknownst to me. I mean, like, shock, it just came out of nowhere. Last August, and when I walked in the door, I had to try not to gasp because everything I had written down to the window sills was exactly
how it came out.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And like you said, wasn't the feeling when you realized that, isn't that a wild feeling?
Very.
When, especially what you said about the manifestation. And I call it rapid manifestation because it does seem to come quick, especially these days. But that's a weird feeling when you realize that the thing you've been focusing on is literally here now. And like you said, it comes out of nowhere and often comes to the person.
Right. And I'm constantly reminding people, I know it's been tough. I know everybody's tired. People are holding space a lot for the light on the planet to be, you know, to be victorious and bring balance back to this world. And at the same time, because of that exhaustion, we've forgotten how to dream. You know, we have lost our inner spirit and spark on just knowing that if we think a thought, that we will manifest. And to think that which we want, not necessarily that which we're responding or reacting to. So I was so intrigued by all of your stuff. I mean, for example, I just want everyone that's listening to this book has a lot of good details and lists for people to review of what to do on how to understand NDEs and the levels of consciousness, one of the things you dove into was the dream state and how to wake up right to remember your dreams. I have clients ask me that all the time. Can you go over that?
Yes, Alexandra. And there's, like you said, the book is chock full of all kinds of esoteric information that is not out there now, especially in near-death research. And but again, the dreams are the pathways to all those experiences. Like if a person wants to get into this stuff deeply and more deeply, dreams is the safest and most natural way to go. And here's a quote, you might have probably saw it, but dream vision, the things we see in our sleep, is the primary method by which human beings experience communication with the Creator. And it's true.
Wow.
So, yes, the right way to wake up. So the person goes to sleep, and before they wake up, when they're dreaming, there are things happening in their head, in another life, in another dimension that that begins to dissipate as the dawning of their morning consciousness comes on, so that that dream memory still lingers if the person wakes up first, their eyes always, if you can wake up without moving, just like people naturally do it all the time, but this time if they can consciously, once you wake up, stay as still as you can, as though you're overtired and you're just looking up, like when a person has a hangover and they open their eyes, they see where they're at, then they go back to sleep. So if the person can just, when they wake up, and stay as still as possible, and then once everything's cool and all right, you don't have to work and there's no one around, you want to wake up, remain in the exact position that you did when you woke up, and then close your eyes again. And you could do a breathing or two, and just remember the last detail of the last thing you remember in your dream, and then the detail before that. And usually those details will help you remember the previous detail. And that's one way you can go back and track what happened in the dream, especially the end, which is usually important in the dream. And then the person, when they're going back in their memory of the dream, they'll remember other parts further ahead in the dream. And they can write it down if they really want to study their dreams, write it down, and they can go over it in the weeks to come. But if the person, remains still, close their eyes, go back into the last memory of the dream, and then the one before that. And that usually brings memories of the beginning and middle of the dream, because these lapses of consciousness that we have in dreams, in near-death and in UFO experiences are, they're just an impediment to us remembering every aspect of our experience or our dreams. And we want to try to have continuity of consciousness. And those can be done through breathing, deep breathing exercises. And that will help us retain each sequential memory of the dream and then later in other experiences. But the memory factor is a serious issue in so many psychic experiences.
Interesting.
Because that memory thing is interesting. And also with that controller aspect, and there is a similar controller in the UFO field too, because I work with Dr. Jacobs. And Alexandra, it seems as though that controller, I never said this on any other interview, but that controller that's in the near death is apparently the same controller that's in the UFO field too.
Wow.
And yes.
Wow.
So that was, yes. I'm always the suspicious type, and during these experiences, I'm naturally like the calm and reserved type too. So I emote, but it takes a lot to bring it out.
Yeah.
Or unless I'm super. So I'm usually calm and collected. But the controlling agent is apparently the same person in both of those experiences. And there's even more to come in that regard in the second book. But so I saw some things, Alexandra, some anomalies in the near death that were so suspicious But I went to Dr. David Jacobs, the world authority, who also worked at Temple, conveniently, and introduced myself and showed him what I had found in my research and asked him what he thought. He said, Eugene, you're 100% accurate. You're 100% correct. And so this was 99. So the next 10 years or so, I would just go over that, revolve it, and see it 360 degrees. Also, I was curious to who this controller was. So I decided, this was during the near-death research, and they lapped where I was working with Dr. J and the one of the other two world authorities at the same time. But I wanted to see personally during the near-death and then years later who this and what this controller was. And we believe that we have, I know who he is, but it's good to say that we believe we found out who and what this controller is. And it's just deep. So you can see where it goes way beyond the psychic ability, some of the things, the other considerations of these experiences. They're just, I can't see how someone could be a normal, you know, I can't see how a normal person, you know, aren't involved in their spiritual aspects of themselves. There's people walking around bowling and stuff and, you know, drinking beers, and they never think, you know, like you could say to someone, what do you, you know, what's the inside of you think about? And they'll say, what do you mean the inside? I'm me, I'm outside. Mm-hmm. Like I have a friend and he eats meat and he's just outside. There's no kind of consciousness inside because he never either avoided that part of himself or didn't know once the person gets back to themselves, then a lot of things can be figured out. But this controller thing is deep, and he's the primary agent behind all these paranormal things. Wow. And we believe that we found out who this agent is. It's very suspicious.
That is fabulous. And, well, you know the old saying, they say that our real world is during our dream state, and our sleep state is when we're awake. You know,
I believe that.
It's completely the opposite. I mean, we supposedly live in this inverted reality, and that's a classic example. You know, I was going to just clarify for the audience that Eugene, because of his exceptional abilities that were developed at such an early age and his desire to really get down to the bottom of near-death experiences, he brought so many details and information that was never available for NDEers and has really compiled a very, very succinct, step-by-step account of what really does happen. And can you talk to us a little bit about when you brought all this stuff forward, you really caught some flack for that, right?
Well, the world authorities were very interested. At first, most of the religious people really liked it, as well as cops and doctors. Those were some of the heaviest customers this last fall. And I thought the religious people would be severely against it, you know, because it involved the mysticism, and which is the union of the person with God. But There was no researcher or scientist, because I work with Grayson and Atwater, who are the both number one and number twos. Dr. Patricia Atwater, she's the number one now, and Dr. Grayson, he's like the dean of near-death research. So those two giants are way out there, and there's not been no researcher to say anything about it. I think the experiencers relate to it more, because they've had some of the experiences that I did. I think the experiences understand it better than the scientists. But with the scientists, the UFO researchers are working at a faster speed than the near-death researchers. It's been 40 years with the near-death, and all we hear is, well, you come out of your body, you meet deceased relatives, you float, 8 feet above your body, you see God, and then you return home. We've been hearing that decade after decade. Right. And then you see the UFO people making a lot of progress. So it's time that the near-deathers, well, I showed them what was happening. But, what was really needed was just a childhood experience to have a near-death and remember it fully and then translate it. Because that was one of the hardest things, translating some of that stuff into regular words so that anyone can read it. But like you said, and thanks for saying it, there's a lot of information. And the scientists, or I know they're studying it, and some physicists asked me to help them with that too. So there's a lot of there's no other book like it as far as life after death or near death in a world, because I was working with the best world authorities.
Oh, well, yeah. And the fact that you just have so much detail is great. I mean, it's almost like anybody should have this on their, in their library just for reference, if nothing else. I'm just going to ask you kind of a silly question. And, because I kept, as I was reading through it, I thought to myself, I had a very, very, really bad car accident in 2001. And, all the doctors said, or many of the doctors said, you know, are you sure you didn't die? Are you sure and I remember I did lose consciousness because I actually remember coming to, okay? But I have no idea how long that was. It didn't feel like it was very long. I didn't have like this, memory of, going and having my body, basically go up and get my review and say, oh, no, it's not time. You need to go back right away or anything like that. So is it possible that if there's this much rich spiritual information to attain from an NDE, I would almost think that everybody on the planet has experienced this, whether they are aware of it or not.
You're exactly right.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because even if the person, like a near car accident, I had one in Youngstown, but like yours, even if the person believes that they're going to die, but don't, that classifies as a near death-like experience. And the after effects come with that too. Mm-hmm. I have a childhood friend who's a football player, and he had a near death, doesn't remember anything except coming to after his coma. And still receives the full after effects too. And even if the person doesn't remember it, they can still, especially if they feel that something was different or higher about it, that qualifies too. The thinking of the person is as much as the actual thing itself. But that's interesting. But
yeah, and what
but,
I was going to add,
you can tell from what you do. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry about that. I was just going to add. You're right that after the accident, I started getting like a ton of information and downloads about why I was here, the mission that I had, what I was here to oversee and develop, and it was very futuristic. Okay. Uh-huh. And I mm-hmm. became like on fire. Mm-hmm. Really on fire to serve the planet from that point on.
It sounds like you did have a near death.
Really?
Because I've seen all the stuff that you know, and you said this was 2001.
Yes.
And I've seen on your website all the stuff that you know and are into. I like that where you do the spiritual cleansing. I like that a lot. The one that Christina had.
Yes. Oh,
that sounds
the implant removal.
Yes, that sounds really good. And so it seems like you did have a near death. And even because they're still kind of classifying what is a near death. If the person comes close to death, if they believe they're going to die, see, just from that accident and when you lost consciousness, once that astral body, and I'm sure you've had out of bodies, once that astral body gets into that esoteric ether, that prana, that electromagnetic energy that's in the air, they absorb a lot, and you can be enhanced just from the out of body portion of your accident, even if it's not remembered.
Interesting.
So, anytime that the person loses consciousness or comes out of their body, they absorb a lot, and then it's remembered or just known or sought after later. But I would say from the way you're describing that, yeah, that was a near-death experience.
So has any research been done regarding people that are put under through anesthesia?
Yes. The people who, in fact, that's a good one. They're trying to, over in Europe, figure out the near-death through that, way. And what they've done is they've put up sign. I thought it was kind of silly, but they've put like a, they've gotten a magic marker and written some words on a sign. They put the sign on the ceiling of the emergency room in the hopes that if a patient were to wake up during surgery or have consciousness out of their body, which everyone knows that we can do, they would see the sign, then come back, tell the doctors, and it could be verified as a legitimate, you know, a proof, quote, that they had consciousness after death. And even children from the cartoons know that there's a part of, there's a secondary part of the person, their spirit, that comes out when they have an accident, you know, get hit in the head with a baseball bat. And the spirit body pops out in times of illnesses, accidents, stress. Even, you know, you could be super upset and pop out of your body. Like marathon runners briefly for maybe 2 or 3 seconds or less, pop out of their body and see it from maybe 30 yards up, and then they shoot back down in it. And it's that separation aspect that's interesting too. In fact, I once was had a staring contest with a squirrel while my son played in this park with some friends. And I was sitting in a tree and the squirrel was in a tree, and we looked at each other. And when the person starts concentrating on one thing, they start to become, the two of them become one. Mm. And I merged, squirrel and I kept staring at each other right in the eye. And then I shot out of my body, shot through him, saw me from his perspective, and then shot into my body within about a second.
Wow.
And that also happened in the astral. So I'm interested in this this merging aspect, and that's what we use to identify and locate this controlling agent in charge. But with the near death, over 700 people a day are having them. So there's some kind of spiritual, yes, thing happening.
Not many, huh?
Yes. And with the anesthesia, Alexandra, when people are cut, the person has the, and sometimes anesthesia loosens the astral body. When people are, you know, when the doctor's operating on them, they're in their spiritual form looking down. They say, I could see the surgeon working on me. Mm-hmm. And they feel when the surgeon cuts their knee to replace the joint, they can feel the surgery in their physical body while it's being done on their, they can feel it in their astral body while this doctor's working on their physical body. And when the person is out of their body, they have a dual consciousness where if someone were to touch the physical, you could feel it in the astral and vice versa. In fact, I heard that Jesus would go into a room with someone who was sick or dead. He would lay down on a table next to them, come out of his astral body, work on their astral body, and then go back into his body, and the person would then be healed. So I heard that he would heal the astral in astral form of the other person, and which would be done by thought activation, and then get back into his body, and when they both woke up, the person would be healed. And I also heard that Christ wasn't killed, crucified for proclaiming to be the Son of God or God, that he was actually, and this was just something I heard, but it kind of sounds like plausible, he was actually killed for necromancy, raising the dead.
Interesting. That's a new one on me. I've read so many different things about why he was actually killed, and that's a new one. It doesn't surprise me because he was a rebel rouser.
Yeah, he was the Jim Morrison of the spirituality.
Yeah, no kidding. And you know, the other thing I was thinking when you were talking was when we do implant removals and we're working on the etheric, there is no question that they will ultimately feel it on the physical. So yes. You know, one is not without the other. They're both very much connected to one another. It's not like they're completely separate entities like people seem to think they are.
Yes.
You know,
and,
now,
yes, go ahead, Alexander.
Now, I was going to ask you, too, I think that we all get confused, and it's very apparent that you've studied all different sorts of paranormal as well as, you know, consciousness-based techniques and that kind of thing. I think we all get confused about lucid dreaming, out of body experiences, astral body, you know, so on and so forth. Can you give us kind of a lowdown on, you know, some of the hottest topics today about that, and what are the specific differences between them?
Yes. Thanks, Alexandra. Sure. Yeah, the lucid dream is like a cousin or big brother to the regular dream, and the out of body is a relative of the lucid dream, so that a person can have a dream, they can realize they're dreaming, and then that dream turns into a lucid dream. Also, during the lucid dream, a lot of times a person will fall asleep and immediately pop into a lucid dream state where they realize they're dreaming. And once you realize you're dreaming, like for an example, a person may have a flying dream. And as they're flying, they realize this is super real because they can feel the wind on their face. They can see the birds. It's so surreal that the person realizes that this has to be real. This can't be real because I'm flying, so it must be a dream. And once they realize that they have a dream, the lucid dreams changes into an out of body experience where the person is either conscious in a dream like state, wherever they were heading in that dream, but they're conscious in it and they can interact with that dream activity, or else they wake up invisible but conscious in real life. And the out of body can be attained through a lucid dream. In fact, I used to have a dream where I go up a ladder in the dream, which was actually the spirit body coming out of the physical. At the top of this ladder, I would be standing on the top rung. All the rest of the ladder would disappear, and I would just be on this one little bar. Of course, I would slip off and fall. So I had this dream over and over and over until I realized it was a dream during one of the falls. And I said, if this is a dream, I won't get hurt. And I said, and in fact, I should be able to fly. And once I said fly, I started flying. Mm-hmm. Also, and so if a person can control their dreams, which you can do just by visually repeating the same visual pattern in your head as you go to sleep, and you will begin to merge, especially if you use the breathing exercises, merge into that dream scene. You almost walk into it consciously. And the breathings is the bridge that the person takes, and the breathings will get you into the dream physically and consciously. So the breathing is important. Air is important with all these experiences. That's why they say do the meditation breathing exercise, because that air power does so much for memory and having the experience. But they're all linked, Alexandra, the dreams, the lucid dreams, and the out of body. And with the out of body being the best one, because that shows you that there's another existence after life. There's another existence to this physical life. And the after effects of even just one conscious out of body are outstanding.
Wow. And so a lot of it has, it seems like you have more, I'm going to use the word control over the outcome if you think the thought that I will not be hurt.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, you said it exactly, because when the person is falling in a dream and they freak out and start fighting it, they fall even faster. Just like with the paralysis. And that's a thing that's in out of bodies. That's a thing that's in near death, rigor mortis. And that's a thing that's in alien abductions. So that paralysis is another connector. And there are other connectors too, but that's a thing where you freak out with this primal fear. And then the paralysis becomes even stronger. And I used to fight that paralysis until it knocked me out. And sometimes it was out of body, but sometimes it was more akin to an alien abduction. And paralysis are in the abductions too. So it's enough to make any straight observer suspicious or curious, you know, with these connecting things. And they're all linked together, just like everything has some kind of connection to everything else.
I was going to say, you're familiar with the, you know, the healer's code of looking at all the different bodies, you know, from, for example, you know, you don't just look at the physical body, you look at the mental, the emotional, the spiritual, and there's countless bodies. So when you have had these experiences, do you literally see those?
You can, in an out-of-body or a dream, you can see, a lot of times, depending on the person, you can see or feel, you can see the aura, or you can feel the aura. And yeah, you can see the different emanations from another, like, sentient being. Because sometimes in those things, you'll, like, sometimes in these things, you'll see thought forms. Like, I was in dreams and in the near-death. I saw this thought form just floating by me. It looked like a little brown cloud. And it was really sad. I could feel it fully. In that out-of-body state or in the spiritual state, it's better to go on the feelings and emotions because they're more reliable than the visual and the psychological trying to figure it out intellectually. We're more equipped to deal with that thing emotionally because our emotions don't lie, especially if the person is in tune with their own self, how they feel, how they react to things.
Wow.
But the emotions are more reliable than the visual because, you know, there's like the near-death, out-of-bodies, all of those things are intertwined with spiritual illusions. And the calmer one is the more you can see right through the illusions, just like it's a piece of glass, a glass curtain. And sometimes a person, when they're being paralyzed by an out-of-body experience, and the person is involuntarily paralyzed so that the spirit body can come out and recharge in the prana, the electromagnetic atmosphere. That's where when we rest, it's really the astral body coming out and recharging electromagnetically in the atmosphere. And then we have a dream while that's happening. Then the spirit body comes back in. But not so much asleep, but it's the recharging of the spirit body that gives us our rest, that recharges us. And
that makes a lot of sense because when you don't sleep, then, you know, you're feeling exhaustion. And everybody seems to think it's on a physical level, but it's actually coming up from a higher dimension. I mean, I see that in my work. The other thing I was going to say to you is when you said that it's so much more important to focus on the feeling and the emotions, like that's more reliable, you said.
Yes.
Would that also be interpreted where somebody who is more clairsentient has possibly more accuracy than somebody who's clairvoyant?
It does depend on the person and how well they use those attributes. But the clairsentient might be better able to, the person really wants to just discern between what's real and what's not. And a lot of times the emotions, especially if they're too, like what they have, some of the prime emotions that are in the out-of-body and or near-death and UFO are primal fear and primal ecstasy. And even though they feel good and are super scary, the person has to watch out for any kind of extremes of emotion. But according to how the clairsentient and the clairvoyant, how developed they are in their aspects will show who would be better. Because, I think that would be a thing of personal development. But once you get one, the others start to slowly come in too, where the person can, it's like 360 degree developed. And the others, one will be the initial attribute or development, and then the others will blossom in too. It's like a blossoming thing.
Wow, that's cool. You also talked about, I've been burning with this question to ask you. You talk about the cord, you know, so as the astral body leaves the physical body, you talk about how you saw time and time again that everyone has their body literally move to an upright position at the foot of the bed.
Yes.
And, I mean, that was fascinating. So my question is, you mentioned that there have been cords at the umbilical area versus the back of head. Are there cords anywhere else, or are those the two key areas where the body is connected?
Yeah, those are the two areas where it's connected, as far as I've seen, and as far as I've seen from other researchers. A good one who has a lot of information, and that cord's an interesting thing, because when you want to see it, it's like it's actually a spiritual umbilical cord that harnesses you to the physical while you're having an astral experience. And I was once out of body, floating up near the clouds, and it was in real time about 7:10, so I knew I had to get back into my body to the school. And once when the astral is out too long and the physical needs it, probably for electromagnetic reasons, the astral cord begins to tug on you to tell you it's time to come home. So I felt this tugging when I was up in the clouds playing. And I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay. Like, I was using my will. I want to stay here and continue to float and fly. And then it pulled harder. And I looked to see what was pulling on me. And I've had it from the stomach in the front. And I saw this long cable-like cord. Mine was like more like a cable, like these electric cables you see on the telephone lines. And it went from the atmosphere all the way down into my little bedroom window. And I said, I'm staying out this time. And it began to pull. So we had like a tug of war. And then suddenly it yanked me through the air all the way back into my bed. And this pull was coming from the back of my head. And so when you want to see this cord, all you have to do is look for it and it will appear. And if you don't want to see it, it will disappear. There's also a thing Alexander, that, and you probably saw it, you may have seen in the book, that when a person's level of consciousness changes, the physiology of the spirit body also changes in sequence with the levels of consciousness. And also, at the same time, the space or dimension that they're in changes. So whenever there's a deviation in the level of consciousness, there'll be a deviation in the spirit body and also in the space or time that the person is in. And in the book, it shows where the person will have several deviations of the physiology of the spirit body throughout the afterlife stages. And that's one way you can tell a person will be having a dream, you'll be talking to someone, and they'll suddenly disappear. That's because they either realized where they were and what was happening, or it's an elevation of consciousness whenever there's a change in the spirit body. And when there's an elevation of consciousness, there'll also be an elevation of deviation in the physiology of the spirit body and in the location of the spirit body.
Wow, that's really important. That's fascinating. Yeah. You know, I was going to say too, when you mentioned that you'll start feeling a tugging because the physical body needs the astral body to return, that just brings up a whole new can of worms for the abductions, where they're forcing the individual, they're pulling that individual through their own means, you know, either into a underground base or you know, what have you, depending on what type of abduction it is. You know, do you have any thoughts on that? You know, as far as, because wouldn't they be overriding the natural tendency for the astral body to you know, the physical body to want the astral body to return?
Yes, Alexander, that's a good question. And there's a heavy connection with the out of body and the UFO abduction. And I'm really into the UFO thing too. The scientists, the UFO researchers, like the stiff ones or the straight ones, they're coming. They've heard about astral abductions. The regular people and researchers and people who are into it, like us, we know that there are astral abductions. When people say, and Betty Hill and Dr. Jacobs both had a feud, long-standing feud, about are people taken out through solid objects like walls and windshields, or are they removed physically, as Betty Hill always claimed, because that was her thing. She was taken out of the car. So she stayed with that true thing that she remembered. Dr. Jacobs said that his the people that he regressed were seen, you know, were pulled through windows, solid objects, houses and walls and stuff like that. So, and they, Dr. Jacobs thought, who's a, my good friend, he thought that they were, and I know that they can, taking the people physically. Somehow they were, you know, disintegrating the molecules and taking them physically through a wall, which they could do. But I saw that, and I went, that's where I did the film with Betty Hill. I went down there to do the film and to primarily see what she felt about it and who was right. Do people really get taken through walls, or are they physically abducted? And in the book, I showed that letter where I showed him what I came up with. I thought that they were both right, that the people are physically abducted and they're spiritually or astrally abducted. And that would make sense with the astral abductions, because it's super clandestine. It's super quiet. The person could still be in bed with his wife, yet his spiritual is gone and he's dead asleep. And so then they can also work on the memory systems. It's easier to work on someone in their physical body than it is. That would be perfect for them, because with these bad abductions, one of the things that they're after, or the primary thing that I've seen, is the electromagnetic energy that is contained in our souls. And there's enough in one human to carry them over for hundreds of years. And not only are, when we are abducted, are we being used in the bad abductions for sex and DNA and all that, we're also being used energetically and heavily, I believe. And this electromagnetic is, it's in all of these things too, from haunted houses to UFOs to near death, and the same as the primal ecstasy, primal fear. So there's a lot of things tying all these things together, and we've figured out a good amount in the second book, because there's a full tie-in with life after death and the UFO aliens, and we've checked into that fully.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait to read your second book. It's fascinating. Now, do you actually think when the abductions are taking place, do they technologically extract this electromagnetic field, or are they actually, because you're getting into my, you know, because we're really involved with soul capturing as well, by the way. So are you feeling that when they're doing this, are they literally capturing the soul and putting it in some sort of device, or are you seeing that they're just extracting the electromagnetic field? I mean, what have you run into with that?
That's a good, real good question. And I like that field of study that you're studying, the soul capturing thing. That's really important in these alien abduction. I don't think that they could harness like the Carlos Castaneda and the those guys. I don't think they could harness a person's soul and keep it in a genie's bottle, because of the will. The person has a divine and universal will that can override that, and also they have a divine right not to have anything impede on that will. And them overtaking our will is a problematic too. And that's where we looked at the control aspect in the near death. But I think that they do it energetically, because so many of those things in that spirit world is done through thought actuation, or just like osmosis, where you absorb. Like I went at that haunted house after our initial experience, I went back with Goddaughter. And while she stood around looking, I silently absorbed as much energy from that house, because after 8 days, I'd figured out that it was electromagnetic energy that had been heightened by fear. So I went back to absorb it, and I did. And that next year is when I started the research, and I just knew. And back then, I was always looking for these boosters that would amplify the abilities, and that haunted house is one. And it's supercharged with energy. It's the warehouse of energy. And so I just borrowed some. But I think that the aliens siphon and extract our energy nightly, weekly. as we refuel it. That's why people will go to sleep 8 hours and then wake up fully drained as though they went through a heavy experience. Mm-hmm. That could be one of the, but I think they drain us energetically or spiritually without machines. And the container, it almost doesn't seem like they could harness the soul, since that's, we were given a soul by God, so he's part of that will of it too. Like when we don't want to do something and we say, God, I don't want to do this, he'll come in and intercede. So it's interesting with the containing the soul, because that's something they'd very much like to do.
And, they do. And, you know, just to respond to what you said, yes, we do have the divine right to our own souls, but there is literally a battle going on with the human race being able to take back 100% of their souls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I agree. That's where you really get into, you know, like that's, soul fragmentation is far more than what people perceive it to be. They're literally using a part of your soul. And I think that's what I think is the reason we're looping all the time in prior lifetimes, you know, with this karmic wheel thing, you know, here, is that we haven't had the benefit to receive or be able to capture back our 100% of our own souls. So
yes.
This is, in my opinion, this is the number one most important ingredient for freedom amongst all living beings, you know, and especially the human race, you know. But
I agree completely, Alexandra.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and we have the divine right, but we also are contending with, on a galactic scale, through that divine right and through our free will, we have made agreements, contracts, oaths, etc., that go way back to other very ancient timelines, world ages, etc. And this is where they get you.
Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
is where they get you.
Mm-hmm. And just like you said, I think, like you said, that study of and the researching, the checking out and understanding of the soul is even more important than consciousness and the physicists and people. Everyone's studying consciousness, but that soul is equally or more important, because that's the trophy that they're after. And if we didn't have souls, there'd be no reason to even live, because, you know, there would be nothing further. So I think the soul searching and understanding of that is even more important than the consciousness study. And in 35, Jung's proposed an idea of a division of consciousness, something that we were talking about earlier with the anesthesia and how the person can feel something physically that's happening, feel something in the astral that's happening to the physical body. And also there's a duality of consciousness where the person can be conscious in both bodies, and the physical sensations show that. But the person can, if they want, can look through their physical body up at the doctor while they're in astral form. And it's interesting with that 300-degree vision, spiritual vision, that's called spherical consciousness. And there's the division of consciousness, and that the soul aspect, I would say that's even more important than consciousness, because the soul will outlive the consciousness.
Yeah.
The soul will continue on, even if the person forgets or doesn't remember. But what you're saying about the past lives, there is a lot to that. And I think the scientists should deal with the people in your field more, because you guys are super smart. You know a lot more than many of the scientists. And there's just this, I just think, and I would like to work with more, but I think you guys know a lot and that you should be added in. I mean, you guys are actually way ahead of the scientists, but they should recognize the spiritual community more than they do. They like shuffle them off. And the spiritual people know more than these so-called world authorities and scientists. They're, you know, who want everything to be physical and measurable and all that. And it's just not in that in that realm.
No, and it's really, you know, right now we're being pushed to marry the scientific with the spiritual, and I think that's going on slowly, okay? But mm-hmm. I'm also a big proponent for all of those that spend, you know, they, like you said, they are determined, they are focused, they have made the decision that their lives are going to be more complete and expansive as they enlighten themselves or as they dive into the healing arts. And I'm a huge proponent. I very much am supporting the healing community, however that plays out. That could be somebody that, you know, reads tarot cards, for God's sakes. You know, I mean, anyone who is going into that aspect of trying to assist, this is truly the future, in my opinion. Yeah. This is truly where this planet is going, is all of those that are in the enlightenment community that are striving to perfect their own gifts, because we all have very unique gifts. That's where it's at right now. This is very, very important for us to realize that our day is coming, you know, when people they're going to be seeking us out in a big way. Now, Eugene, I have a question for you. You said aliens control our memory systems. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I wanted to hear what you thought.
Yeah. It's like in more so than in the near death, although there's memory control in that. But with the alien abductions, there's, and for the psyche of the person, I could see where they would control the memory, because there's so much that happens on board those crafts or with those aliens. Dr. J recounts where a group of 40 or so aliens were gang raping an 8-year-old. Yeah. That kind of super demonic stuff.
Yes,
just has to be checked out because this is. The stuff that in the bad side of UFO abductions, the stuff that's happening is super demonic, and it's easy to see.
Yeah.
And that's just a sampling. But what was the initial question, Alexandra?
Well, you were talking about how they control our memory systems. I was just curious, how do they go about doing that?
They're able somehow to just erase or suppress some of the best parts, or that some of the parts that we'd like to remember, they're able to easily suppress those from us, to just erase them out, like with whiteout or an eraser. And that's not fair.
No.
And it's not good for us, because there's more that happens in what we can't see than in what we can. Mm. And the real stuff is happening behind our vision that we can't see, especially with the alien abductions. And why not let them? Is it that bad that we cannot even be remembered, you know, remember it? There's for some people, just having an alien abduction would fracture them permanently, especially if they weren't into the spiritual side at all or didn't believe. I would feel sorry for a non-believer. I don't believe in aliens and it doesn't happen.
Right.
That would freak them out, a sighting or an abduction, and fracture them. If, you know, if there had no belief in it. So it's a strong thing. But to remove seasoned experiencers like you and me, to remove their memory that they can't remember the fullness of the abduction, shows super suspicion to me.
Yes.
And why withhold? You know, and what are you withholding? What happened when I was out of it that you did or put into my head or took from my body? And that just rings, you know, that just triggers, that's like a super red flag to me when you remove someone's memory purposely and then you don't even tell them.
Some are told. Yeah, and not only that, I mean, you are literally blocking an acceleration in their consciousness, right? I mean, you know, just from that fact. Now, I wanted to ask you another question too, because this is something that really resonated with me. There's an awful lot of interviews out there that are already talking about the gang raping, the severity of these abductions that are going on from the so-called aliens. And, you know, of course, there's always the contemplation of, well, are extraterrestrials positive or negative? And, you know, if you go into the, oh, gee, everything's positive mode, you know, in my opinion, that's not a great way to serve yourself.
Yes.
If you're going into the camp of, oh, they're all evil and horrible, that's not serving you either. But I wanted to know if you thought about a lot of these so-called gang raping abductions and, you know, very perverted sexual hostile takeovers. Don't you feel that many of those are actually happening through the military in underground bases and they just stage it?
I've heard about these My Labs and the government involvement in possible government involvement in alien abductions. To the person, it would seem like, how could a human help a negative alien do something to other humans? But you'd be surprised what humans do, and for a little too. I know they know more than us, but
in this reality.
Yes, in this reality.
Yeah.
I just, and also there's, I can't, in a lot of ways, I can't, because they want information from us. So that shows that we know as much as them. That's something I don't want to believe, that they're involved with the aliens in abducting.
Let me throw this out to you because, again, this is my field that I have a lot of experience and study in. And what I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt is that, yes, there are humans that are absolutely capable of presenting themselves as one thing and diabolically doing another. And it's not because it is their original divine spark or soul essence. It's because some other nasty being has literally taken over and is running their ship. That's why you see humans participating, unfortunately, in these horrible experiences with people because they're mind controlled. And also, you know, there's one thing, there's mind control, but then there's also like possession. And and it is so much more rampant than people realize, you know.
You know, in that way, that's totally believable. Because I forgot about the mind control aspect, how easily they could influence a human. And then I also forgot temporarily about the possession, how they could psychologically influence a human. So that's, in that regard, I could easily see that, as opposed to a willing involvement. I would rather see them being forced to, you know, abduct us, fellow humans.
Yeah.
I hope it's not true. It could easily be true, but I hope it's not, because then that would be super too crazy.
Well,
it's crazy enough.
Think about it. You know, the majority of those that are in a position of power that have overseen or are running the military and the political system, in many ways, they are, number one, hands down mind controlled. And number two, some of them are not human. I mean, they just aren't. So, you know, you're dealing with all these different species, such as the reptilians, okay? Not all reptilians are bad. I keep reminding people there's a lot of good reptilians that are actually assisting us, by the way. But the ones that are running this planet, unfortunately, they just really want vengeance, like, all the time.
Because I was in with Dr. J for about 12 years straight, and so I got into that field fully, and it's good to be out getting a fuller perspective and seeing what others think, because the people and the people have the experiences, and people have advanced fully in the last 20 years, 15 years, 16 years. They have taken jumps with this, what they know and what they've experienced. It's almost like it's ramping up. But
you did an awesome job in one of your chapters. I don't remember which one it was. You were talking about the aliens and how they manipulate us, and you provided very detailed account, and I was like, right on, because it really shows how they use the technology to gain control over us.
They do. They are, like I always say, they are spiritual in nature. What is the quote? The bad, and I've had a lot of good experiences with good entities that I would either see as aliens or angels. I actually saw them as aliens first, and then angels as I got older. You know, you would think it would be the other way, but there's a lot going on, and the deeper I look into it, the more evolved and unfolding it gets.
Yes.
Where, like I said, they have different species, and that's fully confirmed by both sides. It's a interesting and perplexing field, and since it's happening in real time, it's fully important. And with a near death, that's something that has happened to a person, even though they have after effects. That's like a memory of an experience. But with this abduction thing, that's something that's ongoing right now in present time, and it's super important to know about it and think about it, and just like you guys do, take every aspect into consideration.
Definitely. Be aware of it. You know, the more that you're aware that this is even a possibility, whether it's in your physical reality or not, just having the awareness that it does exist and it does happen, so that at some point, if you have a friend or even you yourself, God forbid, begin experiencing these sorts of things, you have some point of reference, you know, something
yes.
to respond to. Because I think that, you know, the most... the saddest thing is that there's so many people who have been abducted. It's just like what you're talking about with NDEs. You know,
yes.
700 people a day, or I think you said, you know, having NDEs.
Yes.
I mean, think how many people are getting abducted per day.
Yes.
And it's like the big bad secret, you know, that's shuffled under the rug, because if everybody really realized that the human race has been preyed upon and
yes.
hunted and actually eaten, and
yes.
you know, it, you know, they don't want to handle that. So
they don't.
Yeah, they don't want to deal with it. It's unfortunate. But now, to kind of switch gears with you, because we have about maybe 10 minutes left, and one of the things I really thought the audience would love to hear about is to kind of go back a little bit to the life review room. So after you have an NDE and you go into reviewing, you know, your life and what a lot of people call the judgment, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think the thing that was intriguing to me is, why was it shaped the way it was?
Okay, yes. And yeah, that was a good observation. And I was curious about that too. Yeah, the life review, I'm just looking out the door, because the life review is... Where the person is showed after they die, a 3D, like on flat screens, kaleidoscope type of a portrait of their life, everything they ever did, said, or thought. And the feelings that you re-experience everything you did, said, or thought at the same time, like multidimensionally, just like if a person is shuffling a deck of cards and you can see all the cards at once. It's like that. You see it in your mind's eye. And so in mine, and it's like a prototypical thing of the other experiences, life review, the person just finds themselves. They don't walk there. They find themselves in the life review. And that shows like a lapse of consciousness, which is super important when it's not a continuous stream of memories. That shows that there was a sudden stop or a lack, an erase, you know, that the memory might have been erased during that time. So the person just appears there. Mm-hmm. And it also shows a change in the level of consciousness, because the spirit body changes and the location changes whenever there's a level of consciousness. So when the person's the person, you could say they awaken or they appear in the life review room. And I call it a room, but when experiencers are asked to describe it, it's all you can see is what's in front of you. And then there's like a gray no man's land behind where you just can't see beyond that. So you're shown only these screens and you can see you're in some kind of room, but it's fogged off after that, which is suspicious and something to notice. So I noticed in mine, I was again levitated in the air, held in midair, suspended, and in the middle of this tire-like circular moving room. Now, in mind, the inner bands, if you think of a tire, the inner bands where I was watching what happened in my life, that wall, although the screens remained the same, the inner band went to the left and the outer band went to the right, or let's say the outer band went to the right and the inner band went to the left. But there was circular movement in an opposite way in that room. The room itself was still, but the bands around it were moving, which is similar to a UFO. In a few ways, like the size of the room. It wasn't too big. The things that happened, the levitation aspect, the showing these multi-dimensional images in the person's mind, and the hearing of the voices from behind, but you couldn't really see the who it was. But anyway, the life review shows the person, everything they did, said, or thought. And in the near death, it's actually in preparation. God wants you to see everything you did so that when he comes time for the easy judgment, there's no mistaking what you did, said, or thought, whether it be good or bad. And those things, human things, can be worked out easily with God, who always gives us always a second and third and fourth chance. We don't give him the same amount, but he always gives us an extra chance. So that's like a review of your life in a near-death where you can see what you've done and there can be no, and God watches it with you. And then they do review it, ask you if you could have done things better, ask you what you've done with your life. And then you move on to the judgment, which is a forgiveness. And then God comes to you in the form you would recognize him as. And as the person is levitated or somehow under his direct abeyance, then the judgment begins. And he asks you if you've always believed in me. He asks you too, what have you done for others first? What have you done for yourself to improve it? And have you always believed in me? And if that last question is yes, you're automatically right then in. And of course, that's when the location, the dimension, and the physiology of the person changes because their level of consciousness changes. So, and I will just go through that real quick because we haven't talked about, but the person, has the life review, is forgiven. God comes to the person. You can feel him emanating as he comes. And you're filled with this super ecstasy. It's orgasmic. It's the nirvana level that the mystics speak of. That's that level of super ecstasy that's actually an illusion, because the strong feelings of fear and ecstasy in those near death and a lot of times in UFO or spiritual illusion. And there's a deeper reality behind that, especially if this person stays calm. And so you want to take it all in calmly and not get caught up with the what you see visually or feel, even what you see visually or feel, because they, here's a quote, ecstasy is the, human beings were created by the Creator in such a way that ecstasy is the only dependable mode of conduct / control for sentient beings. Mm. Human beings were created by the Creator in such a way that ecstasy is the only dependable mode of conduct / control. And ecstasy is also associated with that process of transformation between life and death. So those aspects, primal fear and primal ecstasy, are very interesting too.
Very interesting.
Wow.
And you know, I just want everyone to please check out Eugene Braxton's site. You can order his book at BraxtonEugene.wix.com / America's Mystic. I will have it up on the website in case you don't get that. And you'll be able to learn about the 13 levels of the near-death experience, the 14 stages, and everything from the dark void all the way to the discussion with God and so on and so forth. I mean, Eugene's just done a fabulous job of really deciphering what happens when you experience this. This is fascinating. I can't wait to hear about your book, too. And please do me a favor and stay in touch with me because I can't wait to hear this.
I will, Alexandra. And for your listeners, I will cut the book's price and I will sell it for $10 for any of your listeners who get it off my website.
Oh, great.
And, yeah.
So, okay, and, now how do they do that? So they just make sure they put a notation of, just put down GC or Galactic Connection and he'll know that it came from the interview, right?
They can do it that way through the website and do the Galactic Connections initials, or you can type that out. Or just email me and we could do it that way or through the website. But yeah, it'll be $10 for anyone who gets it, who's any of your listeners. Or
okay,
any of your
and
speakers.
Eugene, tell everybody your email address, please.
Okay, I'm at America's Mystic. That's like America's Most Experienced Mystic, all one word. America's Most Experienced Mystic at gmail.com.
Perfect. Perfect. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to quote him by saying, if you love knowledge, you are really loving God. If that doesn't resonate to your being, I don't know what does. Because all of those truth seekers out there that are listening to us, they're going to totally relate to that. So, thank you so much, Eugene. This is really fascinating work you're doing, and it's a gift. I know all of us will, you know, be sending you kudos. I appreciate it. I know how much goes into this, and you know, because a lot of times you're dealing with a lot of, you know, prevention and, you know, resistance from getting this information out. But you've stayed the course, and you've managed to get this book written. And gosh, now you're going into the UFO range, which is really going to open up into can of worms. I can't wait to hear what you find out.
That makes life after death seem like a cartoon.
I was going to say. So thank you, everybody, for listening. As always, sending you lots of love. Please check out our new website at galacticconnection.com. We have a ton of new services and products and all sorts of cool stuff coming up. And as you know, I did make an announcement this week. It was pretty big that we are calling forth the Guardian Ambassadors. If you are interested in that, do not forget to send an email to admin@galacticconnection.com. And if you have not listened to my prior interview, which was an urgent message to the Guardians, please do so. And everyone take care. Have an awesome 4th of July weekend if you live in the United States. If not, hold the space for all of us that we will truly, finally take our freedom back. And we send all of you love and thanks so much again to Eugene.
Thanks, Alexandra.
Okay, everybody, take care. Bye-bye.